You're about to listen to the Complete Developer Podcast, the podcast by coders, for coders, about all aspects of life as a developer.
I'm Will, the curmudgeonly experienced developer.
And I'm Beege, the optimistic newbie developer. Welcome to another episode of Complete Developer Podcast. This week, we are celebrating 1 year of podcasting. It's exciting as we hit our goal for the year an entire month early and have been growing steadily all year long. We put together kind of a special episode where we'll be talking about our apprenticeship process. But before we get started, Will, what have you been fighting this week?
Well, I think I mentioned the medical stuff I'd had. I had a knot basically in the side of my neck that I had to have biopsied and CAT scanned and poked and prodded and interrogated and waterboarded and whatever else they had to do to it. But it turned out it's not anything bad. Apparently it's just like a fatty node there. So kind of pleased with that because I just got the news today that's like, yeah, they're not going to have to operate. They're not going to have to mess with it.
Well, that's good. Those are actually quite common around our age.
But they said, you know, just to kind of, if it gets too big, they can operate on it. But otherwise, you know, don't mess with it. So, that's what I've been doing this week. How about you?
Well, I went to my first conference this past weekend, actually Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
Yep.
You joined on Saturday.
Yeah. And that was Music City Code. And that was pretty good.
I was right here in town. It was really awesome just to be surrounded by fellow developers and learning with peers.
Yeah. Although it was kind of surreal because it was at our alma mater. Yeah. And it just felt wrong the whole time a little bit just because of like the associations I have with that place. Because when I left campus in 2002, I didn't go back.
Yeah. See, your sister was in school while you were there.
Right. And she got out, a semester after me.
Yeah. Did she graduate at the same time I did?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, she was still there, but I didn't come back on campus.
See, my sisters were roughly 4 years or 4 academic years each behind me. So it was like four and then four. So for 12 years, one of us was at Lipscomb.
Yeah. And you were on and off campus, whereas I just walked away and never looked back. And so I go on there and everything's just really strange. I was getting lost and
it was funny. Well, what was really funny is you couldn't remember where things that were built while we were there were because you'd not been to them.
Well, and I'd kind of, you know, I kind of disassociated from that campus really a year or two before I actually left because I was done. I started hanging out off campus and lived off campus. And so, yeah, it was neat, but it was a really good conference. Got to see my friend David Neal, who was just on .NET Rocks last week.
Yeah, listen to that. That was a great episode.
So it was cool running into him. Of course, he was, you know, everybody was occupied, you know.
Yeah. See, the nice thing for me was because it was here in town, I was able to spend time with friends from work and even some of our Code Newbie Nashville community.
Yeah.
We had a few that came out. I know we had one member who was there every day. And I think she and I had lunch. Was it Friday? Yeah, we had lunch Friday. They did a really cool thing called Geek Jam, which is something that goes on a regular basis here in town. But it was basically Rock Band Live.
Yeah.
They had all sorts of instruments and stuff. It was like extreme karaoke or Rock Band Live. I'm not really sure what you want to call it. But
people are threatening to sing Britney Spears songs if they can't get people to come up and
sing with them. Yeah, that was great.
That's a legit threat right there, man.
So what we missed, Will and I went for the beginning of it on Saturday, but left just to kind of go walk around campus during the lunch break and look at the different things and changes. But we missed some of my coworkers getting up and playing.
Oh, man.
I saw pictures and I was like, oh, man.
Crap, I hate that I missed that.
Yeah.
I mean, and the thing is we came back here because we're cleaning up a server.
Yeah.
And we had too much to do.
Yes, so. That's true. But speaking of music, it's about time to roll that music. this week for IoTs, I have something kind of cool. It is a resource instead of a product or a project. This is the IoT DIY or do-it-yourself handbook. And it provides project ideas and glimpses into ways that others are using IoT and some of their latest projects. You can filter based on your platform type, such as Arduino, Raspberry Pi, whatever you're using, and get details on how to manage and control your project using your smartphone and other apps. It's pretty cool, and if you go look there, you'll probably see some of the projects that I'll be talking about coming up, because it's one of the resources that I use to find projects and get ideas for things to do and things to talk about. Nice. Who's talking to us this week?
Well, we did get a feedback message from Mark Carringer, who I actually know. Hi, Will. I'm enjoying your podcast, though I get a bit panicked at the number of things I don't know. I listen to it on my commute to and from Oak Ridge. Here's a topic which I haven't noticed. How do you learn new things efficiently? Given that you could spend a lifetime studying any one thing, how do you get up to speed on something you need for work in the least amount of time? I've come back from Oregon and back in my tech support job. Have decided to be a .NET programmer and am studying for the C# exam, 70-483. Well, we're actually going to probably do a podcast episode fairly soon on learning new things. I mean, that's...
Actually, it's in the list
of... Yeah, it's in the queue somewhere. I don't know exactly how far back it is, but it's there.
It's an episode that is coming up. So I like that you mentioned that, Mark. Thanks a lot. We do have one that is coming up, and we'll actually put an emphasis on learning it quickly, or how to learn in the least amount of time to fully understand and be efficient.
Yeah, or learn enough to actually be able to get something done, because you're never going to know everything, right?
That's so true, yeah. No.
But yeah, that's totally a topic we do want to cover, and it is in the list, so just look for it soon.
And Mark, thank you for your message. We've got some CDP swag just for you. And if you'd like a CDP swag bag, leave us a review in iTunes or comment on the website or any of our social media. We've got all our episodes up on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Google+ for the five people that use it.
There's five on there now? That's like a 50% growth.
Yeah, I got a rag on Google+ because it's funny too.
Well, you know, the thing is they missed such a good opportunity. That thing could have been amazing.
Yeah.
But they failed to launch.
So, Will, this is your topic as you are the mentor.
Yep. And we had a hard time coming up with what we wanted to do for the anniversary episode. Like, this is probably idea number 15 or 20 or something.
I mean, we'll go through some of the better ideas. One of my favorites was one that I just wasn't able to pull together in time, and we may do it for our next anniversary, but I wanted to get a panel of hiring managers and recruiters and other people and do a live recording with an audience that could ask questions.
Yeah, and I wanted to do something potentially like interviewing one of my mentors.
Yeah.
That was one option. Let's see, I'm trying to think. We had quite a few that we kicked back and forth, but this one is, I guess, a little bit more personal.
Yes.
As far as the podcast goes. So we decided to go with that, and we kind of plan things last minute sometimes, and this was one of those. But mostly the former.
Well, it was...
We got in today and we discussed what we were going to do, and this felt like the right thing. So that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, it did. And sometimes that's the way you got to run with it.
Yeah.
You know, especially for creative ventures such as a podcast.
Yeah.
So
I guess to get started, maybe if you could tell the listeners kind of what your mental state was, or kind of how you got to the point where you decided to switch into software development. Because I know, you know, we discussed that like the first episode, and there were 14 downloads or something. And
25.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. It went up. but, you know, kind of describe where you were. And
all right. Yeah. So I guess a good place to start would be high school. And I'm going to skip around over a lot of stuff, but in high school, I took my very first programming class, which was QBasic, and absolutely fell in love with programming computers. Well, mind you, I had always been kind of a sci-fi geek and into technology and stuff. But that's when I really, really fell in love with programming and working with computers. And so I took two and a half years of programming. I only took a half year my senior year because I wanted to take drama too. But that's another story. However, that summer, I worked with my mom, who's a nurse, and decided I wanted to be a doctor. Because I really, the doctors were showing me all sorts of really cool stuff. And so when I went to college, I started off pre-med, biology.
Then you got shown some cool stuff in psychology.
Yeah, I got shown some cool stuff in psychology and really wasn't feeling the gen chem.
Yeah.
I went psychology and then went to grad school, then decided it was either a PhD or going to medical school. And so I thought, well, I originally wanted to be a doctor. I might as well go for that. So I followed that dream, went to med school.
Got married
while
in med school. Yeah,
big mistake. Should have waited, but you know.
Yeah. Well, everybody does the things they do.
Yeah, that's true. And so got married and made it through my first couple of years of school and didn't quite work out with the marriage. I had some family things that had gone on in my extended family that were taking a toll on me mentally and emotionally, which compounded by studying 16 hours a day while trying to help out in a clinic, which was part of my studying, and just, all the stress of medical school on top of that emotional stuff drove a wedge between myself and my ex-wife, and one that couldn't be fixed. We ended up getting divorced. I took some time off from school and moved back up to Tennessee and was talking with you and he who should not be named, even though we have named him.
Yeah.
But I was talking with y'all about basically what I should do, because I wasn't sure I wanted to go back to school and I'd have to jump back into things there and deal with
catching up and all the emotional entanglements there, and
being away from pretty much everyone I knew, because the only people I knew down there
were her friends,
her friends and her family.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah, you were, Beach was in pretty rough shape, I guess, at this point. Like it, that stuff, because it wasn't just like what happened was not just a, it wasn't just a bad event. It was like a cascade of bad events. Like you were just sitting there and you looked like you were waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Yeah.
And
it wasn't, it was any one thing that happened wouldn't have been overwhelming, but it was a cascade failure.
Yeah.
It was just, it started and just kept building and building. And so I was in a pretty, pretty rough emotional and mental state. And wasn't sure I even wanted to go back to school. Wasn't sure I wanted to be a doctor at the time, because I just didn't see any joy in it.
Yeah.
And that's when you guys mentioned, well, hey, you used to be really good at programming and really enjoyed it.
And you had natural, that's the way you think.
Yeah. And so you said, why don't you give it a try? So I think you guys pointed me to some free resources just to basically learned some basic stuff just to see if I was even interested in it. And I took to it.
Yeah. Well, and let's be honest, part of our strategy was keeping you occupied long enough for things to calm down.
Yeah.
I mean, let's not discount that, because that was part of it. And then you all of a sudden start asking all these programming questions and we're like, uh-oh, we set the hook.
Yeah. And I can remember I would spend hours sitting at my computer working on stuff and then come over here. And at the time, I guess when I first started, you were working at a different company, but also it was contract and you had the business here. So you were working here on the weekends. So I'd come in on the weekends and sit down and work on my own stuff while you were working on.
And I would periodically get up and help you because like at that point you were like figuring out like looping and classes and you're like doing the beginner level stuff and periodically, you know, calling me over when you needed explanation of something. Mm-hmm.
And also you would call me over sometimes when you were doing something interesting to say, hey, check this out.
Yeah. And I did a little bit of just like running stuff by you too.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of, at some point we decided that, hey, he's pretty much an apprentice because, you know, a lot of companies will do the summer intern thing. And what they do is they bring you in, they go, okay, you're a junior dev. Here's some junior dev tasks. We're not going to let you get outside of the safe box of stuff. Well, I didn't have time for that.
Yes.
And so if I was dealing with something nasty, you were sitting right over my shoulder watching me deal with something nasty and explaining it. And so it was much more like an apprenticeship type scenario. And I think that really actually worked out pretty well for you. I mean, I guess I probably did shield you from a few things that were, you know, either really particular to the environment that we were dealing with or that were maybe well above where you were at the time. And then we looped back on it because some of the stuff like with the data access layer I built, there were some things in the innards of that. If you remember when you first started, it was like, yeah, let's not mess with that just yet.
Yeah, there was a few times where you were like, I got to work on some stuff that is just...
Well, some of it was challenging for me, too. It was like, I can't narrate this right now.
Yeah. And during those times, because it was really well the way you had it set up, because you had a card table behind your desk that I sat at. And we had
a whiteboard.
Yeah, when I wasn't watching you or you weren't explaining stuff, I was sitting at my computer going through projects on my own. And eventually I got to a point where you could start giving me some small tasks to do.
Yeah. And I ended up doing that. Well, of course you built the podcast website and you built your own website. And then, this past April I had a conference in Vegas and I desperately wanted to get my website off of WordPress because I was done. Yeah. Just too many hack attempts and too many random interruptions from that environment. And I was initially going to do it myself. And then I realized, you know, hey, Beej is broke and desperate. So, which you were. Yeah. And I was like, you know, I could probably like pay him to do this. It would actually be good experience for you because you could go look, you know, I built this and it's got Node stuff. It's got Grunt stuff and it's, you know, it's a different platform and all that. Whereas if I do it, like it's not really piling something on my resume that's of value to me at my level. And then the other thing is you were staying at the house anyway, because, you know, I had, you know, you were dog sitting here and, you know, so like I fill up the beer fridge, you know, I pay you some money. Actually, I paid you after I got back to build the website. And then, you know, I flew off to Vegas and you took care of the dogs and wiped out the beer, among other things. And, you know, like there was no margarita mix in the fridge either.
You didn't tell me not to.
I know. And yeah, I had to like totally like replace it before it got noticed. I think it did get noticed, but it was only briefly noticed in passing. So it was not too big of a deal. I was like, oops. But yeah, I really think that this is a pretty good way to onboard somebody into programming. Because a lot of what happens when you're trying to learn, especially in a classroom environment, is like, look at the programs. Well, you had programming classes in high school. Mm-hmm. And the programs you build in there are stupid.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, why would I ever want to do this? And why am I doing this thing when I have a library that can do it?
That's something that we have a mutual friend that just recently started working with me. And she's going through... one of the local boot camps.
Yeah.
You know, at night, she's lots of experience as a designer. And
yeah, she's really good too, by the way.
And which is what they were looking for at work when they hired her was a designer that wanted to learn development, that could work and talk with developers about design and grow into a front-end developer. And so one thing that she and I have talked about is she's told me some of the tasks that they have. The other thing that she's complained about is they will show, well, there's two big things that I've noticed. One is they say, oh, well, there's 10 different ways to do this, so you pick the one that you think works best, and not show any of them.
Yeah.
And then expect you just to know. And then the other one is showing you how to do several different simple things, and then
expecting you to chain them together.
Yeah. And it's not just a chain them together. It's a, here's a huge, massive problem.
Yeah. I
mean, there's jokes in the development community about, and like, it's like learning math and you learn, you know, how to solve for X. Now do differential equations.
Yep.
Yeah.
Good luck, buddy. Because if you survive this, you are Newton.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to have to figure out how to do all that stuff. And, yeah. You know, when I was, you know, trying to get you up to speed, you know, the big thing for me was thinking a whole lot about what sucked about learning in school. Because, you know, I went through the comp sci material and there was a lot of stuff, you know, that was low level and it's helped me, like assembler programming. Right now at work, because of all the Delphi stuff I'm doing, I have had to debug assembler.
Yeah.
It's real nice actually having a debugger, by the way, because I didn't in school.
Yeah.
I feel like a real programmer. But like actually trying to adjust that and go, okay, what, you know, treating it like a science is fine if you are trying to become a computer science professor. Mm-hmm. Or you're trying to do AI research, or you're trying to do, you know, something like that. When you're trying to build a website, that's really not the way that you should approach it. You know, like it'd be like a Major League Baseball pitcher throwing a ball, you know, like his thing is being able to put a ball on target and it hopefully not getting hit. But it's almost the thing. It's the same problem in math, I think, too, which I realized this year, unfortunately, years after I got out of school. But math classes do not teach math as a useful life skill. They teach it as this is a rigorous discipline, you know, whatever, which is great for somebody that is trying to be a math teacher. But for somebody that's trying to use math, it's the wrong approach.
Mm-hmm.
And comp sci is very, very bad about this. Because if you can show somebody, hey, look, here's a way to be creative, here's a way to build the thing, and here's a way to have that joy of figuring that out, they'll figure out the rigorous stuff.
Because they'll want to.
Yeah, versus them wanting to punch themselves in the face for showing up for this stupid class because it's awful.
Well, that's one thing where a lot of the boot camps are coming in and trying to solve that problem by teaching practical skills.
Yeah. And some of it, too, is, you know, I guess with the boot camps, one thing I have seen with people I've talked to that have come out of there is because there's a couple of parts. One is the actual technique of solving a problem. But the other part is trying to impersonate the mindset that a programmer has that's actually successful and that like their way of approaching problems, because it's applied scientific methodology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, how do I formulate a hypothesis about what's going on? And then how do I test it? And then how do I fix what I found? And doing that in as tight of a loop as you possibly can. Like, that's programming.
Yes.
But getting somebody to that point, you know, comp sci overdoes the science side of it. Because they go, oh, you know, well, how can I tell this method is slow? Well, we're going to do a statistical analysis. It's like, run the thing. Is it slow? Yes. Like, I don't need stats to tell me that. You know, I can use stats to micro-optimize and adjust, but I shouldn't go to it first, and that's what they do. But the other side is, which is what you see out of boot camps and, like, you know, quick coding. You know, learn to code in 6 weeks and get $100,000 a year, which you're not going to do, by the way. Like, after 10 or 12 years, yeah, you can probably pull six figures if you've been disciplined about what you're trying to do. But, you know, the 6 week coding boot camps, okay, you're not going to learn how a CPU works. You're not going to learn how You know, the hard drive pulls data out, right? You're not going to learn all those things. You're not going to learn Boolean algebra, which you're going to need at some point. You're probably going to have very rudimentary understanding. I mean, it's just a compressed timeline. And a lot of those things are very much geared towards more of a programmer as plumber.
Yes.
Kind of mindset. Versus
tradesman.
Versus programmer as scientist, which is what comp sci is doing wrong. And so there's got to be a place in between those two that's more of almost like craft beer. It's like programmer as artisan. Yeah, you understand like enough to...
An artisan or even as an engineer.
Yeah.
Though...
I'm hesitant to call... the term software engineer increasingly bothers me because we don't call... Just as an aside, we don't call a defect a defect. We call it a bug. And we pretend like it's this little thing that is just, oh, it's just a little annoyance. It's like, no, that bug has AIDS and malaria.
Yeah.
And it can eat an eyeball. Like, if you treat it like that, then it's a, then that's legit. But, you know, that's not the way it's treated in either program.
Do you know the history of the term bug?
Yeah. Was it Lovelace or was it Grace Hopper that
Grace
found
Hopper,
a,
I think.
I think it was Grace Hopper that found a bug in, like, one of the old-timey mainframes.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was vacuum tube-based setup, and a bug shorted it out.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, that was legitimately a bug, right? That was an environmental factor. That was not a defect. That wasn't, oh, yeah, we just had an integer overflow, and yeah, you know, like, just totally, like, dumped too much salt to this guy's bloodstream, and he's dead. But hey, it's a bug. You know, it happened, man. Stop being an idiot.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Anyway, so... Going off on that wild tangent, that's a personal pet peeve of mine.
Well, it's funny.
So we're not engineers, right?
Yeah.
But we're not, like, you don't want to be the widget turner.
No.
It's, it's a thing of, it's like comp sci is the production of fine French wine that takes like 15 years to, as an apprentice, to even be allowed to make. And it's like trade, you know, programming school stuff is here's a fermentation kit, go. And you want to be at a place where I make something that's drinkable that people like. Because it's a tradesman type thing. And if you get between those two, that's a real good spot to be. Because people can afford to pay your salary and you can actually do something worth getting paid over.
Having been working with the Code Newbie Nashville group the last few months, a lot of the members of the group are current students or recent graduates of coding schools.
Yeah. Well, like Nashville Software School.
Yeah. And
they seem to be pretty legit too.
Yeah. And one of the friends that we made just recently got a job. She was very excited. She's the one that we saw at the conference, and she told us she was number 7 out of her class.
Yeah, well, and they're not quite a boot camp either. Like,
no, they're not.
They're a legitimate school. Like, they're kind of in that golden, they're in the Goldilocks zone that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
As far as what it's supposed
to be. What I'm getting at is not anything against boot camps or computer science degrees, but they both need something after.
Yeah.
Because that boot camp, it's going to give you the practical tools to do the job, but
the theoretical underpinnings.
Yeah, the theoretical underpinnings to be a true artisan, they just don't have time for in the time frame that they have, and it's not what they're for.
Right.
You know, I know several of the people that I know that have been to those boot camps, the ones here and other places, went in with college degrees in other fields. I looked at going to boot camps, but my financial situation was not to where I could afford it because they do cost a lot. And, you know, a couple of years ago, they were not getting any type of funding. And they're starting to get better about that. And I recently posted an article where they're looking at getting federal student loan funding.
Yeah. And they probably should because it's actually, that student loan is actually a productive asset.
Mm-hmm.
You're able to make something that somebody cares about and will pay you for versus a lot of the degrees out there that we won't mention. you know, and I come from the other side of it with the comp sci, because I graduated with some people who were very capable programmers. Mm-hmm. I also graduated with some people that couldn't code their way out of a wet paper bag. And you know what? They had the same degree. And some of those people went into the workforce trying to be junior developers with no skill. Like, and it wasn't, you know, they could understand all the theoretical underpinnings, but they couldn't solve a problem. And that's very dangerous. And so this is why we kind of wanted to talk about this, is because I think the way we worked out to structure the apprenticeship thing for you pretty well worked. Well, I mean, I know it worked. You've got a full-time job as a developer now, and you tested above what your level was too.
That's true. For those of you guys that have not started looking for a job yet, when you do, you pretty much have to go through recruiters. And even if you don't, the places that will hire you directly tend to give you programming tests.
Yeah.
Like skills tests to make sure you can do what you say you can do.
Yeah. And that you can reason well, because a lot of it is just seeing that you can solve things, because that's why they're paying you.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, because I did, I tested probably at like the top of junior into mid-level.
Yeah. Didn't you test as like a, you did test as a mid-level at one point.
On because, some of them.
Well, and some of the stuff that you threw out too, you're like, oh, that's this design pattern. Or, or, oh, no, you could do this with an expression tree. And they go, what? I thought you were a junior.
Yeah.
And then you have to go, well, see, my mentor was a real jerk.
I did surprise some people with some of my whiteboard problems solutions, just because what really got me was I had one, and I think I've mentioned it on the show before, but I had one interview where I could not remember the method call.
You just re-implemented it.
Wrote a bubble sort.
I've done that before too, where like I couldn't remember the name of a method, and I'm like, you know what, I'll write it, and we'll just pretend that header file doesn't exist. Is that good?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go.
And I just remember I told the guy that asked me the question, he was one of the lead developers on the team, and I told him, I was like, you know, I can't remember the exact method call, but I know what it does. And he was just curious to see what I would say. So, he may have just been trying to call my bluff.
Yeah.
So he was like, all right, tell me what it does. And so I wrote a bubble sort for him, and he was like, wow, you actually do know that.
Yeah.
Here's the method call. He's like, I'm impressed. He's like, I didn't expect that.
Yeah. And a lot of that really was a consequence, because, I mean, this wasn't something that was my idea, right? This is something that we really kind of worked this out organically.
Mm-hmm. We didn't even call it an apprenticeship.
Until one point we were like, that is what's going on here.
Well, it was one of the recruiters that I was talking to said, because he talked to you, and then he talked to me, and you had said what you said about it before, like that he's not an intern, but
yeah, because the other thing too is that there was not a paying relationship, right? You were in here and you were studying, because hey, I had fast internet and I'm working from home anyway, and of course, when I'm working from home too, the other thing is you don't really have a whole lot of interpersonal interaction, so you're glad to have somebody over after a while. And that was the setup. And so it wasn't like you were an intern with me. It was more like, hey, here's what I'm working on. It's sort of like you were the guy pumping the bellows at a blacksmith or something, and then eventually you learn to use the hammer.
Yeah, exactly. And so we had been calling it an internship because that's the only term we could think of.
Yeah. And then I started getting questions from people about stuff I was doing and what you had done. And I was like, okay, we're using the wrong term to describe this, because it is making them ask questions that put you at a disadvantage.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't about what, the thing isn't like so much, well, what did you do at my company? Because, well, I had a paying project. You weren't billing hours on it. And I'm not going to lie to them.
Yeah.
But the other side of it is like, hey, look, he's capable of doing this. He has done this on his own stuff.
Yes.
And so like renaming that to get them to ask the questions that gave them the answers they should have had if they were smart enough to ask the right questions, was kind of what we had to do.
Yeah. It was a recruiter that finally said, well, it sounds more like an apprenticeship than an internship, after talking to both of us. And we both talked about it and we're like,
yeah, that's yeah, exactly that's right. what it was.
Yeah. So we reworded it just because, you know, he provided a term that made more sense than what we had.
Yeah.
And that fit. And the more I've studied the apprenticeship model, the more I think that is a good model for software development.
I think so too, because, you know, like if you go to trade school, like if you actually learn how to become a welder or a plumber or something like that, you know, you get a program that, you know, gets the point of like, hey, here's an acetylene torch. Here's how to not burn your hand off. Like that's what they teach. Here's how to do basic welds and all that stuff. And then you go and you work with the tradesman. And
yes.
You know, you build up your skill that way. Like that's the apprenticeship model. It's like get them enough where they can actually function and understand basic concepts and then refine those with an actual teacher face to, you know, doing real work, not doing academic problems.
Because the academic problems, you can have complex academic problems, but they don't have the same real world.
Well, they're not resilient. They're not problems that create resiliency. Because yes. The thing about academic problems is they are designed to be academic. In other words, there's no variance to what goes on. There's no thing of, okay, you're 2 days before the deadline and something massively changes and you've got to figure out how to get the water out of the boat, basically.
Yeah.
Like you learn so much just getting slammed in the face with that kind of stuff that you can't learn in an academic environment because how are they going to simulate it? Like, yeah. Unless you have a teacher that's an absolute sadist, which I've had.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm really good at database, by the way. Thank you, Michelle. But
she's a really nice lady.
Yeah. Well, she made sure that we were capable of surviving because I think she understood this principle at a deep level too. But the fact is you had to adjust to, you know, a weird environment. You had to adjust to priorities changing. You had to adjust to, oh, wait, we can't do that because other people on the team aren't capable.
Yeah.
And that is what actually forces growth. It's the same thing as evolution, right? Like the main force that drives evolution is death. It's the failure of the non-resilient that makes the system resilient.
Yes.
And it's the same thing with your coding practices. And that's what academia misses. And that's also what a lot of your boot camps miss too, because they have to simplify. Because, you know, the teachers don't want to be training 20 apprentices because that's horrible. Like, you know, it's very much, it's almost like the Star Wars Sith thing. You know, there's a master and an apprentice, and there's a reason there's only two, because it's a lot of work.
Well, that's true, but take a look at, I hate to even mention these, the prequels. Anyways, yeah. take a look at the prequels. Look at how the Jedi were set up.
Yeah, and that's actually a pretty good way to put it. Like, you get the basic skills, like, here's how to not cut your arm off with a lightsaber.
Yeah, you learn the basic skills in a classroom setting, and then you get assigned
a mentor, and then you go. And you go actually do something.
Yes.
Because the other part of it is, too, is when you are spending years and years learning something, it's very, and not actually seeing a value that in the application of those skills, like, oh, I wrote a program and I got an A. Like, that's nothing. I mean, it's like emotionally speaking, that's nothing.
Well, let's look at some other industries. Medicine, for example.
Yeah.
So here's, you've got the big teaching hospitals, but the way it typically works is you go to school, your first 2 years are classroom. You're learning the science behind it.
Right, because they don't want patients dying on the table because you didn't.
Yeah.
You know.
So you learn that the first 2 years, and then you go your third and fourth year and you do your clinical rotations where you may be a part of a team, but you're assigned to a physician and you follow them around and you learn from them. And then you go into the medical version of apprenticeship, which is residency.
Yeah.
And you go and you are working on patients. Your first year, you're under the supervision of, you know, the head resident, and they're under the supervision of an attending physician. Yeah. It's like you've got several people above you that are reviewing everything you do and guiding you and helping you out. And then you move up that chain and you have fewer and fewer people above you and you have people below you that you're reviewing.
Yeah. And then eventually you come out the top.
Yes.
And that's a pretty good model. And I think medicine, you know, part of the reason they're getting this right is because, hey, if we screw up, people die.
It's a scaled up version of what's been going on for centuries with medicine.
Well, and that's the way all professions were taught. I mean, you typically got your parents' profession. Well, why? Well, because they gave you simple tasks. You were in that environment. You saw things. And they gradually built it up to the point where they could put you on the work, whether it was a farm, whether you had a bakery, whether you were blacksmiths, you know, or even, well, some cases, if you were a priest, the whole Middle Ages thing going on there. But, you know, like that was the way this was done. And we've switched the model to one that's very much in the head, which I think probably works okay for English majors and it works okay, you know, for some engineering professions, but we're not a pure engineering profession.
That's true.
And, you know, honestly, I'm not 100% sold on how well it even works for those, but it definitely doesn't work in tech. And so this is the way we structured this for you was I had to help you get up to a point where you could actually comment and jump in and you understood things where I wasn't having to explain basic, you know, real basic stuff.
And then once I got up to that point, of course, one thing I've been waiting to talk about this, but I think this is a good point in the conversation, is I had to learn to admit I didn't know something.
Yeah.
Because that had, in part because of med school, had been trained out of me.
Right.
You know, you don't want to admit you don't know something. You know, at best you say, this is what I think and I'll look it up and get back to you. But a lot of times you would be showing me something and explaining it and go, you know, do you know what this is or this concept is or that? And I just kind of nod because I didn't want to feel stupid.
Right.
And it took me a while to get over that.
Well, and that's why I would push on those kind of things a lot too, because that's one thing when I've been an interviewer, that's one thing I look for is can this person admit they don't know? Because I don't want to be at the end of a sprint right before a deadline and find out that they don't have something done and they haven't started because they didn't want to look dumb and they couldn't ask.
That makes perfect sense. Of course, I will say that I also took the full med student mentality with that. And when you mentioned something that I didn't know,
I never had to tell you anything twice.
Yeah.
And I never had to, like, if it came up, you know, then you were like, you got up to speed very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And that tends to help, you know. And the other thing too, is you were able to, if you still didn't get it when you were digging into it, then you're asking questions and they're actually useful questions, not dude, Google.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even though I was going home and looking them up, I just started saying, you know, I really don't know that. You know, give me some details and I'll go look it up and ask you any questions I have. And then as time went on, there were fewer and fewer of those times.
Yeah.
And it became more and more me saying, hey, I've been working on this or I've been trying this out.
Well, you know, here's the thing about computer programming. Like, if you're programming a computer, you're essentially giving an idiot instructions. Like, think of the dumbest person you know and imagine they're completely literal. They have perfect memory, but they're dumb and they're completely literal. How do you explain things to them? Okay, now you just have to make that thing where a machine can parse it. Now you're a computer programmer. So half of this, too, was getting you the skill set and the mindset and the approach to things that allowed you to get employed. Because the idea here is to build a set of skills that causes you to get hooked on solving the problems and be able to ramp up from there. Because I also recognize it's like, look, Beej is not going to be writing code for me a year from now, probably. Or he might, you know, he might be doing contracting, but like, it's not gonna be his full-time job because I'm not planning on expanding the company. And so the idea was to get you to a point where you could be in a situation of growth, which I think is also part of the problems with a lot of the boot camps and the comp sci degrees is they don't set you up for that. They don't, they think that they're in charge of the whole process. And then when you're done, you're done and you're a black belt. And it's the same thing really in martial arts, right? Once you're a black belt, congratulations. You probably won't kill yourself sparring, but yeah, you're not at a level of mastery. You're at a place where you can learn.
That was one that took me a long time to emotionally grasp.
Yeah.
When we started doing martial arts, because I had not really done martial arts before. And I had the movie mentality of black belt means,
yeah,
you know, you're the master, you're the expert.
Yeah.
And really it's black belt means you're now ready for the real learning.
Yeah. You've got the basics.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I remember when that realization kind of hit you, because it was like, wait, this guy's a, because I forget who it was, that it wasn't the person we were training with, it was somebody else. This guy's a moron and he's a black belt, but he's, you know, he's capable. And that's what that means. It's like, yeah. And that's really what this part of the training is,
yeah,
has a problem with, is it's not getting you up to the point where you do have the base skills so that you're employable, so that you can start tightening that feedback loop.
And I think a lot of these are built around the idea that your first job out of them is going to really be more of an apprenticeship than a job.
Yeah.
And
it doesn't matter how far you get. Like my first job out of college, you know, I was shown how to do, you know, stored procedures. I was, you know, there was a lot of stuff that we didn't have in school, you know, like messing with IIS. I mean, there was stuff that I had to do every day, mm-hmm, and somebody had to show me. And of course that has continued to the present day. It just gets nastier.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even going through the apprenticeship here, this is one thing that I did tell a lot of interviewers, is in certain areas, my depth of knowledge is closer to mid-level.
Yeah.
Because they were things that you were working on or that we delved deep into. But my breadth of knowledge is at a junior level. That has turned out to be really well because, for example, there's been a couple of times that my boss has, you know, I've asked questions that were true junior developer level questions. And he was able to explain them in terms that he knew that I knew more, like, in depth about.
Yeah.
So, like, we were able to have those conversations and he was able to compare it to where my depth in that area went faster because I was already had knowledge in other areas.
I just want to kind of encourage the listeners to try to get a core level of knowledge to the point where you can provide value to somebody else, because that's how you actually learn, right? Like trying to do the same program in 12 different languages doesn't help because it's not valuable to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get, you know, massive level of mastery of one thing, like you're not going to get feedback quickly enough. You're going to get burnout and you're not going to succeed. Like everybody's got to eat. But if you get to the point where you can do enough where you're actually useful, the person is going to, if it's a good place to work, they're going to invest in you,
mm-hmm,
at that point. Like be able to solicit the investment.
Of course, my situation was a little bit unique too, in that I had some programming background, so I already had that mentality. And the mentality is not vastly different from the medical mentality.
Yeah.
You know, the problem solving isn't vastly different, but I had to learn modern techniques and languages. I would really say the apprenticeship started when I took on my first active coding for you. And
I would agree with that.
You know, it started off with,
I think that was a couple, that was like one of my clients, I think. And then
it was some stuff that I was just helping out with, writing some small things for you.
Yeah.
And then when we decided to do the podcast, it was almost like a rite of passage or test that you gave me by just having me do the entire site.
Yeah. Well, the idea was I threw you in the thick of it and I was like, okay, we'll find where the gaps are, because this will prove, like this will show them,
mm-hmm,
clear as day. And I threw you in there and then, like, I got busy with work and came back later than I had intended, and everything was done. And I'm like, well, that little piece of CSS needs tweaking. And
yeah, you got kind of nitpicky.
Yeah, I had to get, and I was sitting here going, crap, you know, I've got to, like, I don't want him to be cocky, and I totally screwed up the timing on this, so I got to, like, kind of bust him a little bit.
Yeah.
And it was just, yeah, it was entertaining, so.
Well, honestly, you did it the right way, because you were like, there's not a whole lot I can really critique you on this.
Yeah, because you spent a lot of time on it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you had the mobile layout working, and, you know, there's a lot of stuff was pretty solid.
Part of it, too, is I had put the effort into building it, and I knew what it took to do it.
Yeah.
So when you were saying, yeah, you put a lot of effort into it, I'm like, yeah, I did. I know I put a lot of effort into it.
Yeah.
And I appreciated that affirmation of I did the right thing.
Well, and that's the other thing too. And this is something I don't monitor as closely with you as I do, like with my daughter, but I don't tell my daughter, you know, hey, you did this, you know, you did well at this, you're really smart. You tell her you worked really hard on this. And it's a social engineering thing that I wasn't as cognizant with you, because it's like, well, you know, I'll tell you you're an idiot, but you work hard. No, I didn't.
You will.
I will. Yeah, I totally will.
and I did a few things in other areas where you're like,
what?
You put a lot of work and effort into us, but you're an idiot for doing it.
Yeah.
Well, wireframe. Yeah. Right, so that we're getting.
Yeah. Well, you and I had that discussion pretty early on about the difference between force and work.
Yeah. And getting into that. So that was my first real full project.
Yeah.
All right. And that was for something that was not paying, because up to that point, I hadn't gotten paid for anything I'd done.
Yeah.
And then the next thing was some work for your site that.
No, the next one was for a friend of mine's site, wasn't it?
I did paid work for you. It wasn't
the rebuild. It was something else.
It was something else. But I did some work for you that you paid me for.
And I can't remember even what that was.
You told me, you're like, your skills are at a level where
you can do this.
You deserve to get paid for your effort.
Yeah.
And so.
Well, and I also insisted on that pretty early too.
Yeah. You paid me for that. And then we had one of your clients who was someone that I know, but.
Yeah, he called me up, and I sent some work over to you. And part of the deal was, too, is like, you know, I'm going to have to ask Beej a bunch of questions if I take this on. Or I could just give it to him, and then I could be, like, classed as helpful instead of classed as lazy.
Yes.
Even though I'm both.
Well, it worked out really well, because it gave me the full process. Because before, I'd built stuff for myself, or I'd built specific parts for you.
Yeah, and I spec'd things out. And so that forced you to also learn how to write a spec, which I told Jay, my friend. I was like, look, some of this is learning for him too. So, you know, he's going to have to build a spec and all that. Like, I'm requiring that of him. And then you went like full on hardcore on this. You went like full med student. You never go full med student. And that's what you did on the spec. And I was like, okay, I need to rein this in a little bit.
Yeah, I did. Experience now, I look back and go, wow, what was I thinking?
Yeah.
But I know what I was thinking.
And I knew what you were thinking, but when I encountered that, I was not sufficiently prepared.
Because I
didn't call you an idiot. I was just like, what?
Yeah.
why are you pushing so hard on a block wall? You know, you're not getting any work done. You're using force. Yeah. And that was entertaining.
I look back at it and laugh, because. And the great thing is, because the client knew that it was a learning experience for me and everything, he was very understanding.
Well, he talked to me. He's like, you're going to razz him about this, aren't you? And I'm like, I'm going to razz him.
Yeah.
Don't you worry. But yeah, that was fun. And, you know, we're a year in on the podcast, and I'm trying to think. Did we start the podcast? Was that a year after you started picking up a little bit of coding? Because they're kind of blurred together. You got back.
I got back in 2000.
It was 2014.
2014. So yeah, it was a year
after you'd hit rock bottom.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, so we're 2 years in, and you've gone from, you know, just to lay all this out for everybody as far as the value of this kind of process, you've gone from I need to figure out something to do. I have a little bit of, you know, very very rusty experience writing Pascal code. High school on Windows 3.1.
Yeah.
Or DOS, probably. It was one of the two of those, probably. And I'm thinking about doing programming to 2 years later, you have a full-time job, or you're contract to hire. But
yeah, I'm contract. Yeah. Well, it's still, I mean, I work a full-time schedule, and you know,
Well, like if you were a freelancer, that would be, oh, I'm a freelancer now. Like it's not a thing of like, that's a distinction without a difference, or the other way around. I forget which.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's a different term for you've achieved the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so this was effective, and we were able to get you to that skill level because we treated it as an apprenticeship. So that's kind of our 1 year recap.
Yeah. That pretty much wraps it up for us. Before we close everything out, Will, what do you have for us this week for Tricks of the Trade?
Well, I'm just going to go ahead and give the rant that I aborted early in the episode because it kind of needs to be said. I've just had a lot of really bad software experiences over the last 5 or 6 months at least. Actually, I guess it's been longer than that. It really all started with Windows 10. And that is the big thing for me is the mindset that a lot of developers have that a bug doesn't matter. And that might actually be true if it's something that's cosmetic, you know, in some cases, but most of the time the bug does have an impact or people wouldn't notice it. We tend to trivialize the danger that a software bug can create. And I want to point out some things. We are getting into a more interconnected world. The Internet of Things is getting to be the Internet of Everything. We have devices connected that, you know, that manage, you know, watering crops. We have devices that are flying in the air. You know, Amazon's about to start delivering packages with drones. Interconnectivity is everywhere right now. And with it comes a lot more systemic risk when you ignore problems. It's very easy to create cascading failure conditions in an interconnected world. And the biggest, most critical thing with this is your software has to be able to fail, and it has to be able to fail quickly. It has to not spread the contagion of failure to other places. In particular, this means if you get a bug, you know, something blows up, you don't pass bad results on to something else and cause that thing to fail. You blow up on the spot where you are. It also means that you have to be very careful when you're deploying software. You can't sit there and go, oh, this is a, you know, this bug is a problem and it may affect a whole bunch of people, but let's push it out everywhere. Or let's push out everywhere and, you know, damn the torpedoes, as it were. Because what happens is now you have a problem of interconnected nodes failing, and you have a cascading system failure versus one node failing. It's very, very easy to really screw up. So I'm just want to kind of throw this out as a rant. Stop calling them bugs if you possibly can. I'm still trying to break the habit, and I'll still say it, but stop visualizing them as mosquitoes that you swat. Start thinking of them as mosquitoes that carry the Black Death and AIDS and Zika rolled into one, because that's a bit more what it's like. It's something that poses a systemic risk at this point. We're not a young industry where there's failover for a computer going down. Recently, I think it was it Delta or was it American Airlines? You know, they had a software glitch that basically shut down their flights everywhere. That was not a bug. Okay. That was a problem. That was a defect, and it blew up in everybody's face. There's people that didn't get to relatives' funerals because their flights were canceled. There's business deals that didn't happen. There's people that missed connecting flights and missed part of their vacation or couldn't get back to work on time and were out of paid, you know, time off. And so they had to, you know, basically take leave. And oh, by the way, they're burning through cash when they're stuck wherever. Little bitty things compound when you connect more stuff to them. So get away from the idea that defects are acceptable. That's all I got. If you have a question or comment for us, please email us at neckbeards@completedeveloperpodcast.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from Stand By for Titanfall by Pure Bells, available on SoundCloud and licensed under Creative Commons. The intro music for IoTs is Hillbilly Hip Hop by Jason Belcher. For references, show notes, and to sign up to our email list, be sure and check out the website at CompleteDeveloperPodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at CompleteDevPod and like our page on Facebook to keep up with the news about the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time.